Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Murder 123. This is Dr. John Stamey. It's great to be with everybody. Holiday season. We've got New Year's Eve coming up tomorrow, just to date this podcast. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I know I'm going to be out with Cody Haynes at the Market Common Times Square New Year's Eve in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Come on out and get a caricature. That's going to be a lot of fun. And I'm excited about it, and we'll be under our tent. And it's not supposed to be so terrible tomorrow night. So, you know, it'll be a good time whenever it's not cold. It's supposed to get down to about 50, 45. So wear a jacket, come out, and have a good time as we usher in 2020. That's going to be a lot of fun. My partner in crime co-host is here with us, the one and only Robin McCray. How are you doing tonight, Robin?
I'm doing great, John. Excited about another show. They get better all the time.
Well, they kind of do. I tell you, my favorite show
we have a lot of
was
fun
last
with it.
Time. It was Anna Nicole, and I just love Anna Nicole. And we'll see if anything pops up with all of that. But anyway, so glad you're here. And for all the Murder 123 listeners that don't know, I hung out with you family over Christmas, and it was the best time. We watched Doctor Who. We watched a whole night of Doctor Who, which I love. And then saw, what did we see? Christmas with the
Crank.
Who? Christmas,
like
with,
Christmas
the crank.
With the Crank.
That was so good. Tim Allen, Dan Aykroyd, and Jamie Lee. She should have won an Academy Award for that performance.
Wasn't
really
that great?
It was. And then we saw The Elf with
And we saw Christmas Vacation with Chevy Chase.
Christmas Vacation. That turned out to be so hysterical. It didn't start out very good, but boy, it really ripped up. So it was a lot of fun Christmas with the McCrays, and it was a lot of fun. And Janice Carter.
We have to make it a tradition.
We do, and Janice Carter and her daughter Holly were there. We had a grand time, and wanted to thank you very much for all of that. And
it was our pleasure. We loved having you. It's going to have to be your Christmas spot.
Then you made me a Christmas stocking. You put all that candy in there. I finished it off today. So that's all good. That's right. Now, I want to talk about tonight's show. Tonight's show might be a little different for a lot of people. It is called Murder on the Track. This is about two murders that revolve in and around that marvelous, marvelous sport of NASCAR and short track and dirt track racing, which I'm, thanks to our guest who's coming on in a couple of minutes, Zach Beechler. He's been my coach and my professor here for the last couple of weeks, because he and I and a friend of his, Brady Vance from Iowa, we're starting a new podcast called The Charlotte Line. That's going to be on Tuesdays at 10 p.m. So you better check out The Charlotte Line. I'll be doing stats. Zach and Brady will be talking about racing. It's going to have a blast. And we'll be making several appearances around some of the dirt tracks and some of the short tracks here in the Carolinas. So we'll let you know when. But I can tell you we're going to be in Kingsport, Tennessee on April the 10th. That's the beginning of their season, and that is the week after the 5500 in Bristol, Virginia. So now, Robin, we're going to have to get you and the crew out to one of these dirt track races. There are a lot of
love the dirt track.
You're a fan of racing, aren't you?
I am. I got into it accidentally, and I loved it. Yeah, I used to go down to Florida, Daytona, every year. And Michigan International Speedway, and we just camp out there the whole time. Saw some of the dirt tracks down in Florida, sprint stocks. It was fun. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really like it. Living in Myrtle Beach, I'm fortunate to have one of the premier short tracks in the country, Myrtle Beach Speedway. It's like 3 miles from where I live in the state, because I travel a lot to Greenville, South Carolina. There's the Traveler's Rest Motor Speedway. That's a bang. short track and dirt track. So I mean, it's a lot of fun, and they're adding a dragway, and so there's a lot of cool stuff going on. The only thing that I hate, I'm in Charleston so much of the time. However, the Somerville Motor Speedway is no longer, and I kind of hate that because,
yeah.
You know, so it's a shame. I hate that, but we'll probably do kind of a walk by to it. Then we're definitely going to head up to the North Wilkesboro Comic Con, to that legendary, the North Wilkesboro Motor Speedway, where everything happened, where the Lowe's race occurred before it moved short, because so many people, you just couldn't get them into the North Wilkesboro Speedway. So we're going to be going and having some fun. And as I said, I'm going to find out what's the closest track to Columbia, and maybe you and your crew can meet me and my crew. You've heard those phrases before. We'll have us a blast. And I can tell you what,
yep.
Some of these short tracks and dirt tracks, as I've been looking at them, boy, they got some good food there now.
They do. They move on those tracks.
They really, really do. So Zach will be with us in a minute. He's getting situated. He was kind enough to drop in with us here at work. He's at work right now. He one of those nights he had to work very, very late. So he just texted me. He'll be in a couple of minutes. And we're going to be talking about two of the most famous deaths associated with the racing world. Now, I'm going to go ahead and start and talk a little about the first one, and that is Chris Trickle. Now, Chris Trickle is the nephew of very, very famous Dick Trickle. And Dick Trickle, I mean, a lot of people may not know this, but he passed away 2013, and he was 71 years old. In Dick's career, he raced in over 2,000 races. He completed over 1 million laps on short track, and he won over 1,000 races. I mean, this man was a machine. He was billed as the winningest short track driver in history, which I think he was. And this is great. He won in 1989, at the age of 48 years old, he was the NASCAR Winston Cup Rookie of the Year. I tell you what, being 48 years old, being a Rookie of the Year, I think that is a huge accomplishment. I mean, he's out there beating the heck out of all those 22-year-olds. Hey, 22-year-olds, you better watch out. Some of us 40s and 50s might be able to wear you out sometimes. So I'm just kidding. But anyway, now on to what happened. Dick's nephew was Chris Trickle, and he lived in Las Vegas. He was a stock car racer, and he was actually murdered in a drive-by shooting freeway in Las Vegas. And to this day, we do not know who did it or why. And it was crushing to everybody. They have a race up there at Las Vegas Motor Speedway in his honor, which is great. Chris Trickle, he started racing motorcycles when he was 8 years old. And by the time he was 15, he had two track championships to his credit. That's amazing for a 15-year-old.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
Then he started racing. Then stock cars came in 1990. He was the 1992 Rookie of the Year in late models at the 3/8 mile track in Las Vegas Speedway Park. And he finished third in the season points with 3 wins and 18. Incredible, racing against all those pros. His career and his popularity really grew with the fans, and he was scheduled to join NASCAR's Craftsman Truck Series in 1997. I mean, he had made it to the big time. Now,
yeah.
On February 9th of 1997, he left his home in Las Vegas. It was around 9 in the evening, and he was going to play tennis with a buddy of his at a lighted court. Now, while he was driving on the freeway there, we don't know where it came from, but a car drove alongside and shot into the car and hit him in the head. I mean, just in full blood. A year and 7 weeks later, Chris Trickle, he died from complications from the wound. That was March 25th, 1990, and he was only 25 years old. A great, great career stopped in the prime of his life. And now,
what?
It's interesting. Pardon?
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, when the shooting happened, Nevada law limited murder prosecution to 1 year and 1 day after the death. But with Chris Trickle's death, they changed the time limit. So they removed any time limit for prosecuting murder in case they ever found out who killed Chris Trickle. It's still unsolved, and it was featured on America's Most Wanted. I mean, this was a gigantic, gigantic thing when it happened. Now, Dick Trickle, his uncle, actually committed suicide in the Charlotte area when he was 71. And I mean, that's such a sad ending to a great, great race. And Trickle apparently had all the good stories. It's kind of like Maestro has all the good stories from wrestling. Well, Dick Trickle was the man when it came to the stories. I mean, you've been in racing as a fan and someone that knows some of the racers. I mean, what do you think? What is your take on the drive-by murder of Chris Trickle? What kind of vibes do you get, Robin?
I don't get that it was random to begin with. I mean, a couple things, okay? Number one, mm-hmm. This is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and that's being conservative, okay? They probably make trillions and trillions of dollars. Now, these guys, years ago, before NASCAR was NASCAR, you had these drivers doing stocks, you know, sprints, all of it, and midgets, and they were already in the big league then until it became NASCAR. When NASCAR became NASCAR, they just erupted. They were massive. Okay, they're the biggest thing out there. When you get these big things, these drivers are competitive. And in a perfect world, we'd say, well, nobody would ever try to hurt the other driver. That's not how it works. I can remember years ago when I was a kid, I showed horses competitively. And I went up against the pros. And I went to this one show, and I'm thinking, you know, I was a kid. I was 12. And here I am showing against these professional adults and kids and everything else. I showed jumpers. So it didn't go by an age class. When I did hunters, it was ages. But once you get in jumpers, they don't care. As long as you get over the fence, you're clear and you're fast. We had to put policemen outside the stalls at night because people try to kill the horses and us. And NASCAR is this huge, huge business. I mean, the fans love it. The drivers love it. But there's also this fierce competitive nature that they have with each other. I would say 99% of the drivers would never hurt another person. But there's that 1%, and that's all it takes. And I'm not saying that, you know, one of the drivers did it, but I am saying that whoever this is, they knew what they were doing. They knew who they were looking for. I mean, they literally, they pulled right up alongside him.
Well, now, I hate to mention this, but we are talking about Las Vegas, Nevada. And we are talking about
the
U.S. capital of
everywhere.
Gambling. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, that's all I'll say. I want to cast no aspersions to one of the greatest spectator sports, along with wrestling, in the world. But I mean, it is Las Vegas. And
mm-hmm.
there's no telling.
Who knows? NASCAR, you know, the drivers at NASCAR could be clean. Maybe a gambling debt. There's not a lot of information that fills in these blanks. Like when I first started, you know, thinking about it and reading about it, and I'm thinking, you know, even if this were set up like with this suicide, I mean, how do we even know that he really tried to commit suicide? There really isn't a whole lot of information on how he did it or why he did it. It's just he did it on Dick Trickle. Now, he was a huge name years ago. So why all of a sudden, he had everything to live for. He had a successful career. Why in the world would he want to kill himself? But yet there's not anything really written about it. And then you look back over at Chris Trickle. He was on top of his game, too, and it looks like it's a drive-by shooting. And I just don't think that was it. I think there's not enough information that's been made public to determine that. You're talking about Las Vegas. You know, you've got the gambling casinos there. You've got the mobs are there. You know, plus you've got NASCAR drivers there. And it doesn't even have to be that this has anything to do with NASCAR, but he was on top of his game. But we don't have any information. Did they try to rob him? you know, or what happened with that. And then when you look at the timeline, he didn't die for a year and 7 weeks, but yet we have nothing knowing on what went on in that year and 7 weeks that were these complications.
Well,
like they've kept everything too quiet.
Well, it's a lot like the investigation of Chris Benoit. And we talked about this 3 days. They import a medical examiner from West Virginia. They do the autopsy. 3 days later, goodbye investigation. That thing was closed up.
See, that's the thing.
Tighter than a drum.
Well,
and, you know.
Oh, I agree. I agree. You know, I just think that they've kept so many of the intimate details or fine details to really kind of be able to put things together. I'm not finding where you can find it. You know?
Right, well, I mean, this is,
but it
you know, maybe
seems
Tony,
to me very suspicious.
Well, maybe Tony and I can look into a Freedom of Information Act request. I mean, I don't know if we can get to it. We still have three more that we're trying to negotiate right now. But it is strange, and what I can tell you is Chris Trickle was a bachelor, and Zach, I spoke with Zach earlier, he believes he was living by himself. So the car perpetrated this murder could have followed him from where he lives and could have gotten
absolutely
to a point where nobody could find him. And, I mean,
yeah,
they, you know, you do it on the freeway at about 8:30 at night. I mean, you know, nobody's going to see this.
No.
And
I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Know.
We don't know if it was, you know, these were people that needed money for drugs or what have you, or if it was a robbery gone bad. Nobody knows. There's just not enough out there. But then what's so perplexing to me is that if you look back at Dick Trickle, and he commits suicide, but yet there's nothing out there that says why in the world would this man who was doing so well in his career, had everything to be proud of, why did he commit suicide? I mean, what was the point in that, especially so close to when Chris died? I mean,
it just
seems very odd that he got hurt.
Well, here's what's interesting about Dick Trickle is that I was talking with Zach, and he said that Trickle had a shop there. He worked with a racing team. He had a shop. They were doing very well. Dick Trickle was still getting there, and he was working on cars. Apparently, he loved what he did. And whenever you see someone that
appeared to be someone that would want to kill himself.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're on fragile turf here. You know, as we're talking.
Yeah, I mean, did he find out something he shouldn't have? Or, you know, I mean, there's got to be a reason. If he even truly did kill himself.
Yep, there you go again, as Ronald Reagan would say, and you hit the nail on the head. It has been told that he committed suicide. That's all that we know. We don't, you know, nobody knows. And there are many, many reasons that the cause of death.
Well, and I guess if he truly did, and I'm not 100% convinced, but if he truly did, then there's the age-old question of why. Why would a man that has success, has his own business on top of the success he's already had, and from the outside in looks like he has the world the way he wants it, which is usually not the entire case. You know, we don't ever see the normal everyday stuff. But then what would be so bad enough for him to give up this career he worked his whole life for, the shop that he built? What would be so bad that he, you know,
the great
I
accomplishments
mean,
that he made, yeah.
It just doesn't
but
make sense to me. So either something was going on that nobody had privy to, or did he find out information about what happened to Chris, or was he aware that something could have gone down with Chris? And he didn't think anything about it, and he blew it off, so he didn't say anything, and then Chris ends up dead, and maybe there's guilt there, which I'm just speculating. I mean, there's nothing to base that on. But I'm just saying there's a lot of possibilities that could go through there that would make sense to tie it all in.
Well, I guess in terms of making sense, it does not follow based on his life that we know. Again,
right.
We don't know
what
happened.
We know what they want us to know. I mean, we don't ever know the truth. We know what they want, what the powers that be want us to know.
And that's true. And like if it's a money problem, people don't really notice that stars go bankrupt. They go bankrupt all the time. Then they start doing more personal appearances, and then they've got money again. So, I mean, nobody really notices the bankruptcy. Willie Nelson, no one – I doubt if anybody really remembers that he was bankrupt at one point, and he did a concert to raise money to pay back taxes and get him out of that, and he was doing fine. And Willie Nelson's got a lot of money now. And so we'll never know, but I can tell you that it was kind of a mess. Now what I'd like to do is I want to cover the death of Kevin Ward Jr. Starts out with Tony Stewart was NASCAR. He was Winston Cup champion in 2002, 2005, 2011. Now, Tony Stewart, in the first decade of racing in this century, was as hot as you could get. Now, you had a little bit of experience with Tony, just you knew who he was and all this stuff. Tell us a little bit about what you know, if you don't mind.
No, the thing is, you know, and did I know him personally? No, I didn't. There was a time that somebody that I knew, we were supposed to meet with him, and we decided against it. He was so controversial in the beginning, and I'm not saying that he is now because I haven't heard a lot of bad stuff about him lately. You know, we all grow up at some point. Hell of a driver. You know, you can't knock his talent. But he was like trouble with a capital T. He literally fought, argued, raised hell all over the place. And I'm not going to say that the other drivers didn't like him because I personally wouldn't know that. But there was always trouble when he was around. I mean, he was always getting suspended for this, and he'd jump out of the car screaming and cussing and carrying on, and he'd get suspended for that. I mean, it was always one thing after another around that time span. And, you know, I remember when all that happened, and, you know, he didn't even really, how it ever ended up, I don't know for sure, but that I ever heard of, I don't know that he ever really got punished for anything. But it seemed like he would do all these things, and I don't know who would bail him out. I mean, at some point you'd have to say, you know, enough is enough, but nobody ever did. He got bailed out every single time. He'd get suspended. He'd have this problem or that problem. He'd always end up back on the track. But the thing is the crowd loved him. He had a huge following, and he was, and probably still is, a hell of a driver. You know, the problems that I saw came from his personality and from him as a person. You know, I mean, he was,
he was a wild and crazy guy. He was a wild and crazy
guy.
And by the way, and now, Robin, I am pleased to say that joining us from the CharlotteLine.com podcast is Zach Beechler. Zach, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fantastic. How's everyone else?
Good.
We're doing great.
Hey,
we got Robin.
Good to hear from you.
Yeah.
I'm
so glad to have you here. And I had just introduced, Zach, the story. We just talked about Tony Stewart. Would you tell us about the incident up there in upstate Kevin Ward Jr. got killed on the track? Could you
of course. So,
fill us in?
So the base of the incident happened at a dirt track up in New York State. The NASCAR Cup Series was racing Watkins Glen, and Tony Stewart's an avid dirt racer. He goes to a lot of local dirt tracks and races. Well, he went to that track, and him and Kevin Ward got tangled up, and Kevin's car got not destroyed, but to a point where it can't drive anymore. And he was upset, which is understandable because you got a big guy like Tony Stewart coming into a local track, wanting to have some fun, race, and, you know, taking out kind of the hometown hero / young gun coming up. Well, what happened next was a mistake on Kevin's part, because instead of playing it smart and staying in his car, staying by his car, he walked down from the berm of the track down to the race line where everyone was, and they were under caution, so they were going slow speed. But at the time, he was wearing a black fire suit, black helmet, and you don't have very much visibility, especially on a dirt track with mud flying up. You don't have much visibility, and there's not much light. Well, very last second, Tony Stewart saw Kevin walking down and tried to avoid him, but hit him with the right rear tire and utterly causing him to pass away. The big issue that everyone kept taking part with is that they claimed Tony did it on purpose, Tony's, you know, a killer, Tony's this. Tony Stewart did nothing wrong. Everyone that kept saying this stuff, and people still to this day say Tony did it intentionally, have never been in a dirt car, never been trying to drive one of these cars. And the biggest thing I tell people is you don't drive these big dirt cars with a steering wheel, you drive with the throttle. And at the last second he saw him, he sped up to try to dive down to the berm, but it just wasn't quick enough, and that would utterly kill Kevin Ward on the track.
Well, and you're on dirt. I mean, you don't have the control on dirt that you do everywhere else. You just don't.
Especially with people saying he could have slammed on the brakes. He would have just kept sliding because they had
that
dirt track to always get it nice and moist. So that way it doesn't kick up a lot of dust. Instead, you get a lot of dirt chunks coming at you.
Yeah, that's true.
And I will say this. I don't mean to cast any aspersions, but the medical examiner did say that he had a high concentration of marijuana.
Right.
Now, So one thing that a lot of people may, you know, disagree with, but unfortunately it is the rule, in all of racing, there is no, you know, ifs, ands, or buts about it. Any race organization, not just this dirt series that they're racing in NASCAR, IndyCar, F1, even your local short track, there's a zero tolerance on any type of drug. Now, if that truly did affect him, I can't say. There's a lot of people that say he did have something that day. There's people that say he had something the night before. No matter what, regardless, it was against, you know, the policy of all racing organizations. And, you know, some people hold that against Tony, saying, well, look what he did. He took, you know, someone that's doing this and this. So, the biggest thing I tell people is I don't look at that part because of the fact that he could have been, you know, he could have done that the night before and it just hadn't left his system. And do I think it affected him at racing if he did that? No. Do I think he smoked during the day? I would hope not, because he knew he was racing that day. But it definitely is something that I tell people, you can look at it and you can take it your own way, because no one knows definitely what when he had taken part with this. I'm still against it at the track because it's against the rules and you can get kicked out for life essentially.
Well, that aside, I mean, any driver would know better than to be walking where he was walking. You know,
and
I mean,
whether
he had anything in his system or not, he had no business being where he was at. Now, you know, as far as Tony Stewart goes, he was a hothead. He always was. I don't know if he still is, but he always was back when I used to follow him and go to all the tracks. But at the same time, I have to admit that when you're on dirt, you don't have that luxury of being able to hit the brake when you've got all that speed going. And you don't have the luxury of just kind of veering off a little bit because you're sliding all over the place. You fishtail on that stuff.
Exactly. Sure. And a lot of people – and one thing that I will say, too, NASCAR had put in a new rule after that incident about telling drivers, hey, unless your car's on fire, you stay in it until – NASCAR officials, paramedics, or fire get to you. It wasn't really a rule at that point. It was just kind of common rule. You know, you can get out and just, you know, they say you can't go X amount of feet. Now there's a definite rule. Unless your car's on fire, you stay in that car or near or, you know, sit next to that car if you have a hard impact.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly a shame that these two deaths happened, one being a drive-by shooting, the other one a result of the situation, the darkness, the dress of one of the racers, perhaps poor judgment. We'll never really know, but it's a shame. But we wanted to talk a little bit about death on the raceway, death at the track, because that's kind of an interesting thing that doesn't get spoken about a lot. And this will kind of lead us into next week's The Charlotte Line, which will premiere at 10 p.m. at thecharlottelion.com with you, me, and Brady Van Sickle. We're going to have a grand time, and it's going to be a blast. And so I got to say, Zach, thank you for taking the time to speak with us tonight. I know you're busy at work, but you carved out some time. We appreciate it.
Zach, hey, it was great to hear from you.
It's great to hear from you, Robin. I hope to see you soon.
Yeah,
okay,
definitely.
Take care.
Take
all right,
care.
Zach, take care. All right, bye-bye. All right, we go from Zach down there in Greenville, South Carolina, to one of the foremost paranormal investigators that we know, Robin. It is the one and only Tony Filosi. How are you doing tonight, Tony?
Yeah.
I'm doing fine, John. How are you guys doing?
Good. Always good to hear your voice, Tony.
It's good to be here. I'm glad to hear you guys' voice, too. I have another murder from Harlan County. Just imagine that,
did you?
Right? Yes.
Tony, that's the only place anyone got killed.
I think it's
amazing. Are there any people left alive there, Tony?
I think whole family trees were wiped out during the 30s, 40s, 50s. But this one tonight actually happened in 1961.
Okay.
And I'm going to read a little bit of a newspaper article and then go into some backstory, because upon further investigation, it actually ties to one of the other murders we talked about Avery Hensley and his stepdad.
Okay.
This is an interesting, it seems like a whole lot of these murders here tied together. But, you know, and another common denominator is a lot of them work for the local PD.
Yeah,
I mean,
see,
imagine
I think that PD was corrupt, or it was at that time.
Oh, my goodness. So let's get
they're
started.
They're always tied into it.
Yes, and it's tied into the police, and it's tied into the liquor trade.
I agree.
What we have here is the two fellows that were killed that night. They killed each other, and they shot one another, and they died within 2 seconds of each other on the street, probably about a half a block from where I work at. So let's start. A shooting on a busy downtown street corner here Friday night ended in death for two hardworking. Police said Don Harwood, 51, and John Glenn, 43, died in a gunfight at the corner of Main Street, during which at least 14 shots were fired. Blanton,
good
the
Lord.
Farmer, hit by 14 rounds down to 10 o'clock at night. But back in those days, Harlan was a busy town, had a lot of people. So there were several witnesses double homicide, and they all kind of told the same story. I'll finish reading the article, then in the backstory, very interesting. Blanton, the plumber, hit by two bullets from Harville's .38 caliber pistol, died in the street. Harville, hit numerous times by Blanton's .25 caliber automatic pistol, died within a matter of seconds later. He was DOA, dead on arrival at Harlan Hospital. Harlan City Police found Harville lying wounded between Friedman's Jewelry Store and Jack's Barbershop. Harville's taxi lot is only 2 feet up Central Street from the scene shooting. Now, what also was sitting there at Harville's taxi lot was a place called Crystal Kitchen, a little diner. And Harville was partners with a Miss Big Hensley that, guess who, you know, we talked about the Hensleys that got murdered a couple of weeks ago, the stepson.
Yeah.
That was the elder Hensley's wife. So now let's try to tie this together. Let's put this in perspective. Okay. Harville actually was involved in that murder. He was driving a car that they accused one of the Beach brothers of getting in. He got out of it by saying he was hit on the head by one of the Beach brothers' accomplices. So within a few months or weeks after Mr. Hensley's death by Cloud and Wheeler Beach, he is now partners with the deceased wife. Now, that's a little fishy to me.
Yeah, I think so.
So, these guys, now how this, how the murder, how this double homicide happened is there was a lady that they were both kind of, it was Blanton's ex-wife. Mr. Blanton hadn't been out of prison very long for cutting his wife's throat. He slashed her throat. He didn't get the carotid, but he cut her across the throat and spent about 4 years in prison for it. When he got out of prison, he would come in on a regular basis to the Crystal Kitchen and harass her. So the night of the shooting, he came in and drinking, and Mr. Harville, he was talking trash about Mr. Harville. I think the quote was, Harville doesn't mean a thing to me. I'll burn him down. Harville doesn't.
What a pleasant bunch of people.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I mean, that was like a strange place to be back then.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know, the guys are looking for trouble. And Harville, with his background, he ran with nefarious sorts. And I guess he thought he could handle it. So Blanton leaves. Harville leaves directly behind him. Witness hear several gunshots. Harville had called up to Blanton on the corner, on the street corner. They talk, they argue. Blanton pulls a .25 caliber pistol, shoots him 6-7 times. As he's slumping down, Harville pulls a .38 and shoots him twice, killing him on the
Tony,
spot.
Now stop. Does that mean in Harlan carry a gun, or did they?
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. It was it was not a gun-free zone. And,
apparently.
God.
But and quick tempers. It was a rough place, and in the '60s it had started. I mean, you still had people, and we'll talk about other murders and later episodes, on up into the late 60s, early 70s, there was things like this that went on a semi-regular basis. Now, as Harville died within seconds of Blanton, he slumps down. As he's slumping down, he shoots Blanton. They both hit within feet of each other. Mr. Blanton being killed instantly and Harville dying just a few minutes afterwards. Now, another interesting part of the story is they were taken to the same funeral home.
They can't get away from each other in death, can they?
No, they can't get away.
And I don't mean to speak ill of that place, but it's like that. It just sounds like the most corrupt city back then. I'm not saying it's like that now, but I'm just saying back then, even the police department was corrupt.
Oh, yes.
I mean, if it looks like a duck and walks like it's a duck, it's a duck. I mean, that police department never did one thing that you would have thought a police department would have done. They got all kinds of people off that shouldn't have been off. And they've got this stack of dead bodies going everywhere. Good Lord.
Well, the first night Blanton had been in there like a night or two before drinking, and they had thrown him out of the Crystal Kitchen. Well, it looks like the police, he slashed this lady's throat. He's back in. She's having to serve him dinner, and he's taunting her. I mean, why didn't they stop that?
Yeah.
You know? And but now Harville, he was a nefarious sort also. He'd been arrested several times for guess what? Running illegal whiskey. Transporting illegal whiskey.
Why am I not surprised?
Right. And again, you know, a lot of this stuff goes back, and when you really dig into it, it's about the liquor trade. Harville was, like I said, he was involved with the murder of the Hinchleys. And within a few days, you know, no more than a month, he was partners with Miss Hinchley. So that makes me question, was Miss Hinchley involved with him? Why would you partner with a man that was a, you know, the getaway driver, so to speak, for your husband's murderer?
Yeah, there's something out right there.
But that brings a lot of questions again back to the police. Why weren't the police more involved? Whenever this guy got out of prison, why did they allow him to go, into the dime? Why did Harville, why did he not go to the police and stop this guy from? So you have a lot of unanswered questions, but. This happened, and again, this happened within a block of where Miss Hensley's husband was murdered, within a block, less than a block. So how is that for irony, for coincidence?
Yeah.
You need to stop asking these questions, Tony, because we all know the answer.
I mean, we could probably, if you focused on nothing else but that town, we could do 1,000 shows.
it gets interesting. Especially since we started Murder 123, I've done a lot more research on true crime here, and it's just unbelievable. And one that we'll talk about here in the next couple of weeks is about a man that hacks his wife up in the back to make sure that part's true, but I know that he killed her, and that was the story that was told. He was very abusive, and I actually have had some interaction with the lady's daughter. I'm going to go back and see if I can find her contact info and maybe talk to her a little bit. If you'd be willing to speak about that.
Yeah.
But I can tell you.
Honey, that's great. Tell us a little bit now. We got a little time.
Well, this happened in the early 80s. And it had kind of a paranormal twist to it at the end. There's a place that I investigate sometimes is probably 150 yards from there, where the murders took place. And we had gotten some really crazy, dark type EVPs one time. This place was like not a lot of activity, and the energy up front was good, and it was like a ranger station, and kids growing up there and family type environment. And every now and then something dark would wander through when we do an investigation. And I really think it's his name was Clyde Fields. And if I go back and find him, I actually have EVPs from Clyde Fields, if I can find them. But anyways, the story goes is that he was very abusive, and that he's obviously he wasn't mentally stable. His wife was on the phone. The story goes that his wife was on the phone, and she says, "Can I forget his Clyde?" She says, "Well, I have to go, Mom. Clyde being really, you know, Clyde ran me a bath that he's been so good to me. And that was the last conversation the lady had. So shortly after that she hung up with her mother, he murdered her. There's a couple different stories, and I'll relate the stories, and I'll gather the facts. One is he hacked her up in the bathroom. He lured her into the bathroom under auspices. He ran her bath, got murdered her, hacked her up, then started disposing of the body. Now, they actually found him outside holding corn or doing some sort of yard work when they finally picked him up when they found him. They searched for him for after they got worried about the lady, you know, I guess they tried to call back later that night or the next day to get a hold of her. So they found her body, her remains. And there was a police officer that lived about a half a mile from where this murder took place. And apparently he and that police officer, state police, didn't get along at all. And they found, as they were tracking through the woods trying to find him, they found some like pork and beans cans and the baby sauce cans and cigarette butts where he'd sat on a little ledge looking over into where this police officer lived. And when he was questioned about it, he says, well, he says, I couldn't figure out which one of them son of bitches I wanted to kill first. And that happened. He went to prison, and he was paroled 10 years later, 15 years later. Because in Kentucky, a life, unless it's a house, worth about 7 to 15 years, and you're back a lot of times. Whenever we're talking about the Beach Brothers, you know, I'll switch gears on you and go back to the Beach Brothers. They were paroled within 6 years, 7 years. And Mr. Blanton was paroled, the one that cut his wife's throat, and he only pulled out 3 or 4 years. So
is that all?
That's it. It's unbelievable. I mean, things like that nowadays, I mean, you would be going, you know, if they gave you a life term, you would pretty well pull a life term. But these guys, it just seemed like it was a revolving door. So again, that makes me think that politically there was a lot of politics involved.
There has to be.
Yeah.
You're talking about a corrupt government on top of things like that going on. There's a tie there somewhere.
Yes, definitely. So, but I'll get some more information on Clyde Fields, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a few weeks. But that was just a stone cold, insane gentleman right there.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Golly. Well, Tony, it sounds like you've got enough stories from Harlan, Kentucky to keep us occupied for quite a while on the cell block, and we appreciate the research you do and telling these stories. It gives us kind of a little picture of what a peaceful small country town was really like, and it was not peaceful, Tony?
No, it wasn't peaceful. Bloody Harlan got its name honestly.
Well, Tony, I have a question for you.
Okay.
When you got into investigating in Harlan, did you have any idea the powder keg you were going to find as far as all these murders? I mean, when you went into it, did you already know it was that bigger? After you got in it, after doing the Manziel Shepherd case, you were just like, oh, my God, look at all this.
That was pretty well it. I knew it was a rough place. You know, I used to work in the coal fields. I worked in the coal fields for about 25 years. When I first started, I worked with some folks that were retiring that had been through the mine wars. And then a bunch of them's dads still alive that had been in the mine wars also. My grandfather talked about them, and then I was pretty rough predicaments myself. Because in the early 80s in North County, it was still a little bit like the Wild West. There wasn't anything shootouts downtown, but it still, when coal was concerned, it was you had to watch the kitchen cues. There were still
people. Was the town down there now?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's daylight and dark. It's daylight and dark. It's nothing like it was even when I started in it. And I can give you a little backstory. How rough it was. I was 19, 20, just to turn 20. And I had to, we had trucks, we had coal trucks. My dad, actually he did, and I started working for him. I got into the business. And it was so rough that I had to get him to buy a pistol to go to work. Whenever I was working, I mean, you had people that were threatening you and sabotaging your equipment.
Oh wow!
Oh yeah, I can tell you some stories. Some, I mean, real deals. That's what I mean. No BS stuff. It was, it calmed down in the mid late, you know. But,
yeah.
There was, you know, I know this is a little bit off topic, but we're talking about Harlan County. You know, I was like I said, about 20 years old. And the, I'll tell you two stories. There were some, and back in those days, when you were back in the mountains, you were probably from any type of law enforcement or help like that, you were probably 45 minutes if you were lucky. I mean, if you drove hard, I mean, you were in the middle of nowhere. You would haul coal from the mine, and they would have washers, coal prep plants on top of mountains, and they prep wash the coal, and they would belt it down the mountain to a unit load. And I was like 20 years old, and we were the bit taken off, and people were really jealous of what my father was accomplishing, and you know, had a lot of threats and things. One day, there was some bad stuff went on, and you know, we didn't have two ways instruction. We had like regular CB radio.
Yeah.
And he had hollered. You know, he'd make his rounds. He'd holler. He'd say, "Hey, is everything fine? Do you need any parts?" And he, you know, the hall's going okay. And then he'd be on his way. Well, on that particular beat, you know, no, there's issue. You know, there's problems that you need to come up. So, anyways, they had made threats against him and made threats myself. So he pulls in. I tell him what went on, and he went out through there, toward the mines. He was a bit. He's still alive. He was a Vietnam vet, and so he just drove out to the mines and back. Called him out and cursed him, and he come back to me. Scales, and he handed me a pistol, 357 Magnum, and he said, "You have two choices." And I was like, torn. He says, "Go haul coal or go home." And that's a real deal story.
Okay, great. great.
Go, yeah. Yeah, so go Hawk Cole or go Hawk.
Good grief.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, so that was my introduction, you know. Because you have to remember, but like I said, back then, you know, a lot of those guys, have y'all ever seen Harlan County, USA? About the,
nope.
The last big
no, ride. I haven't.
Check out Harlan County, USA. Because a lot of, see, I started in 81. And that happened in 74. So I'm within 6-7 years of that going on. And there were still a lot of the characters involved in some of these deeds that were still in the business at the time. But it was serious. I mean, it could get serious fast.
Okay.
So that's your introduction to Harley County. So whenever I'm telling you these stories, I've lived a few of them. I've not had to, but thankfully, not shoot anybody or anything like that. But let me tell you something. There were some shootouts actually on some surface jobs. You know what surface mining is? It's where they take off. They go around the contour of a mountain. They take off and get the mountain to get to the coal seams, and they do big flat level. These two guys, two truckers, were into it over some coal hauls. They met up on, this was in the early 80s, maybe. And the kind of thing with Harville and Black, and they met up on strip jobs. They walked up to each other and both up rifles. And they wasn't no time. They just cut loose on each other and killed one another. That was in the 80s, early 80s.
Well, when
but they
did
didn't
it start
think
settling
that
down there?
I'm sorry?
When did it start settling down there?
Mid-late 80s. Mid-late 80s. But, I mean, that wasn't a common occurrence, but those things still did happen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like I said, on up into the 80s, people think that the Cold Wars were the end of it. No, it wasn't the end of it, because as you can tell by the violence up into the 60s, 70s, and even the early 80s, it could get rough.
Yeah.
So I can tell you, like I said, I can tell you, and what I went through or what I seen was just a drop in the bucket compared to what
well,
it was.
Oh, man.
Yeah, 30 years before. Oh, yeah. So that's your insight into the Harlan County coal fields.
Well, I tell you what, Tony, we'll have to have a longer talk on a Murder 123 about this sometime soon, because it's fascinating and fits right into what we talk about. So I think the British ladies are going to come hitting us up here in just a minute. So I wanted to say, first of all, wherever you are out there in Cyberland, thank you, Zach Beechler, for coming on and talking to us a little bit about Kevin Ward Jr. I want to thank Robin for being here tonight. She's had a long day today, but we're glad we had her here. Glad she. And want to thank Tony.
Thank you
Pelosi.
Very much. It's always good to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. And thanks, Tony, for doing the cell block. And we will see everybody next week. I'm working
yeah.
very hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll see you next week. One and only Murder 123. So have a good week, everybody.
Take care.
All right.
Bye. Happy New Year.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.